The Loose Cannons podcast is a free-form discussion about film that contains mature language,
such as poop and titty,
and descriptions of mature situations,
such as filing taxes and raising children.
We do not have any concern for spoilers, so if you haven't seen the film or films we are discussing and don't want to have the twists ruined for you, please watch the film before listening to the podcast.
Hello everyone, Loose Cannons here, coming at you with another podcast. We've got Basil, Ilya, Patrick, and myself, Ruben, here today, and we're going to be discussing 1992's One False Move, directed by Carl Franklin, I guess you would call it a thriller, in the thriller genre?
Yeah.
That's generally what it's referred to.
Sort of a neo-noir, maybe.
I would definitely go there with it.
Billy Bob Thornton and two actors who I don't remember the names of.
Bill Paxton.
Yeah, Rob, drug dealer, and kill a bunch of people, and then they're traveling to Arkansas.
Yep. Correct? Arkansas.
Star City, Arkansas, where Bill Paxton is the local sheriff, and headed for a thrilling collision. And that's the movie we're going to be discussing today. Anyone want to kick it off with just their general sort of did they like it, dislike it opinion, and then we'll go around the circle.
Yeah, I like this movie. In particular, like, I didn't expect it to be quite as bleak as it was, because it's really bleak, and it ends with one of the, like, craziest, darkest, like, you know, conclusions that I've ever seen in a movie, and I was, like, I was really impressed with that, because it didn't seem like it was going to be that kind of a movie from the outset, but, or it didn't, like, I don't know, like, the general impression I got of just, like, looking at the cover for it and then, like, you know, starting it up, like, the way it's shot doesn't look like it should be as dark as it is. And it doesn't, like, necessarily feel as dark, but when you think about what actually happens in the movie, like, it is, like, you know, some of it's almost, like, serial killer territory. And so it's really bleak, but I think it does a good job of balancing, like, with some levity, those, you know, darker scenes in it. What did you guys think?
This is the second Carl Franklin movie I've seen, and part of the reason why I chose it, I've seen Devil in a Blue Dress, which is another sort of thriller neo-noir with Denzel Washington, and it's... I liked the movie, but I would say that it was very frustrating for me. It continues to be frustrating because there's, like, I feel like there's some sort of incredible talent at work here that's not fully realized. And I don't know if it's Carl Franklin's or somebody else's or exactly what, but there's stuff in both this and in Devil in a Blue Dress that to me is really incredible. And then there's also a lot of stuff that's just sort of like filler. And, like, I'm kind of like, I don't understand how the same person could make these two scenes. Like, one being, like, one of the best scenes I've ever seen, and one being, like, just a complete waste of time. Do you know what I mean?
I think I feel maybe the same overall, but not... with the strong peaks and valleys, maybe. Because I've seen both movies also, and both movies left the impression that I had more or less enjoyed them, but neither stuck with me at all. This one, probably even less so. Devil in a Blue Dress had some pretty cool stuff that I latched onto, but I became immediately worried when watching this movie about doing the podcast, because I was like, what can we say about this movie that isn't right there on the surface for almost the whole thing? Wow. Like, we could just say, hey, you should watch this movie if you're interested in it. It will tell you what it's about.
Ilya?
I actually made a, like, I watched this movie a couple of days before we recorded this, and the other ones I usually watch like a day before. So I actually did it just to see whether or not it would stick in my mind. And it didn't really stick in my mind. But I think I definitely thought that there were like some scenes that definitely made it out to be like a more like that the movie was about to go somewhere really more interesting or become something more interesting, and then it never really did. And I don't know, I think like this is definitely like I was kind of surprised when I didn't know that Bill Paxton was playing in this movie, and I usually really don't think of much of him as an actor. Like, I think mostly I remember him with like in Aliens or something, where he was really terrible.
Oh, man.
And here he's like, I don't know, he was pretty believable in this sort of weird, like, lost ball in tall grass kind of, you know, kind of hero in his own mind, country boy, you know, and he was really impressive in that. I thought he was one of the best things about the movie, actually. I really didn't expect that to happen. And I also thought that, like, the way race is handled in the movie is also, like, it tries sometimes to become a kind of interesting, but then it sort of goes back and retreats into something that is just way too confusing or confused about its own intentions, you know? And that's why nothing really, like, there was no scene in the end that really stuck out for me as, like, something really memorable.
Like, so I thought the whole sort of last scene of the movie, like, I'm still, like, thinking about it. I watched this, it was over a week ago when I watched this, and I still think about that last scene, you know, where that he has the discussion with
the
girl.
You really want to jump to the end of the movie, don't you?
I'm sorry. That's the scene that stuck out for me the most, because I saw that and I was like, whoa, like, this guy.
By the ending, do you mean the shootout?
Yes. I mean the whole shootout. And not only that, but the very end of the movie where Bill Paxton is laying on the ground shot and the little kid who is probably his son,
his son comes over. Yeah. There's no probably.
Okay. Okay. Well,
definitely
the little kid who is his son, you know, is just comes over and, you know, is just like sitting there with him and, you know, doesn't realize that his, you know, his mother's been shot in the head. That whole shootout to me was like, and sort of the argument that he has with her before the shootout really stuck with me. Was just like, just because of, I don't know, if I didn't really expect it to get that dark, I guess.
What do you mean by dark?
I mean, like, I didn't expect Bill Paxton's character to sort of become a bad guy as well, because he was really, you know, kind of like, he was kind of a goofy, a little bit put upon character before that, because, you know, he was like, oh, well, I'm going to go wrestle this drunk guy to the ground who's messing with his wife again. That's just how it goes around here. And then he's like, you know, maybe I could be a police officer like you guys. And then they're kind of goofing on him in the restaurant, and he hears them, and he's like, oh, you know, and I'm kind of put upon. And then the end, you find out that he's, you know, basically the source of all of this woman's problems. Because
he's
the one.
I wouldn't go that far, but I know what you mean.
Yeah, he was a catalyst for a lot of her problems. And then you're like, oh, he's, you know, not any less bad than these other people here. And then you have the, you know, the shootout where you think maybe that there's, I guess, like, maybe a rekindling of his feelings a little bit there. And maybe he's going to help, you know, he's going to help her escape. And it's going to be kind of like a, you know, a dark justice sort of thing. But, you know, what happens in the end is even more, you know, kind of bleak and sad because, you know, you get not only...
Are you ready for a very big reading of those scenes at the end? And what they might mean in a very large context?
Sure, sure. How about it?
Bill Paxton in the movie has a white family, and then he also has an indiscretion that he had when he was younger, and he has a multiracial son that he wants to take care of financially, but that he refuses to recognize as his son. And if we see that sort of as, and like the woman is upset that he won't recognize, and she thinks that the son is not going to grow up to be as good a kid as he could without that recognition. And it's about sort of maybe American amnesia towards an entire segment of their population, black people, and not recognizing them as their sons, and how it, the way that it benefits, even if they give them money, the way that it benefits white people, and that money wouldn't be enough, that they have to collectively recognize their sons metaphorically. Mm-hmm. What do you guys think of that?
I can see that
big,
that really
pretty big,
being you know, that's a legitimate reading of the scenario, I would say. But
where does that put the mother, though? Where does that put Fantasia?
Dead.
Just dead.
I don't know.
Dying for their sins. Dying for the sins of the white man or something. I don't know.
Well, yeah, I can almost see it as like, you know, will all be destroyed if we don't deal with this.
Right in the head.
Yeah.
This is the second movie that we've watched for this podcast where a woman gets shot right through the head. With like, I don't want to say what the other movie is in case someone is watching this and they've seen One False Move and not the other one, but you guys know what I'm talking about, and it looks the same too, right? Did anyone else feel that way? Would she get shot in the head? You're like, this reminds me of that other movie we watched.
I don't remember which movie you're talking about.
I don't either.
Well, Ilya wasn't actually part of that podcast.
No, okay.
All right. Everyone who hasn't watched all the movies for all of our podcasts, turn the podcast off for the next 15 seconds. All right?
I can edit this out.
So the end of the movie is kind of like Shane, right? Because yeah, he's sitting there.
You don't know.
He's been shot. We don't know what happens to Bill Paxton.
Yeah, we
does
don't
he
know
live
if
he's
dead.
Does he die?
Yeah, you never know.
Or if he lives from the wound. Yeah, because he's definitely not dead at the end of the movie. Because he's sitting there talking to his son.
So that made me
think
that even more so that the other thing was a reference to Johnny Guitar.
I mean, maybe the whole thing is basically like a, you know, it's going to take violence to get, you know, him to acknowledge this child. Or something like that. Yeah. I don't know. Like,
I was thinking more like the scenario has to end in violence. Born
yeah,
of violence.
Yeah, yeah. Basically, violence is the only thing that's going to get, you know, white America to reconcile with the with their problem.
Yeah, I don't know if I would go that far with Carl Franklin as a director based on what I've seen.
Yeah, plus, I don't know if Bill Paxton really is the right, correct stand-in for white America, honestly. Like,
yeah.
The way he's portrayed in the movie, I think, like, he is, in his own way, kind of a victim. Like, especially, like, the way that the one scene with the two detectives talking basically trash about him while he's standing in the corner and is being really hurt. Like, that moment is, like, I think it takes, like, pretty much all of Bill Paxton's acting prowess to, like, show off some, like, range of emotion in that moment. It was pretty cool. It's like, oh, I'm hurt, but I can't really acknowledge it too much, you know, otherwise, it'll sting too much or whatever. It'll feel like I really am hurt. I don't know. Whatever's going through his mind.
Yeah.
So he never really is, like... Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, they do a variations on that scene twice. They don't just do it. That's the second time that it happens. The first time is when all the cops are gathered around and they're talking to him, and like the entire LA like police force who's assigned to this case is like clearly thinks that, you know, he's a bumpkin or whatever.
Yeah.
And they're all like, they've got him on speakerphone and they're like, oh my God, I can't believe this guy's talking like this. And, both of those scenes, and there was another scene where he was like racist in front of the black cop and his like wife kicks him under the table to tell him.
Yeah.
I was glad that I knew the context that, you know, Carl Franklin is a black man directing this film, because it was a surprisingly sympathetic portrait of a racist.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I was thinking that too, that it was...
I almost want to say that there was something going on here that was like a class thing too, because it felt like the LA cops were all kind of, you know, above everybody else, like class wise. It was like they were upper class, and then you had all the people in Arkansas who were basically like lower class citizens. And so it almost felt like that's what was going on there too. It was like the upper class, you know, looking down on, you know, these lower class people that they have to work with. In a way, so I thought that was maybe what was going on in those scenes.
Yeah, I think that the movie to me was trying to create a pretty obvious like juxtaposition of like good and bad qualities, that the LA people supposedly have more sophistication, but they're also snobbier, and he's sort of like more down homey, but like gets to do police work in a way that's kind of enviable, where he's not just like incarcerating people for breaking the law, but actually has like strong relationships with his community and realizes that like sometimes like arresting a person isn't the solution.
Yeah.
And I also like that.
Good points.
As you say, I also like that nobody who, you know, ends up getting shot at the end is ever really kind of an, you know, innocent in that scene, because even the woman who gets shot is herself a murderer, you know, as we see earlier in the film when she shoots the police officer that stops them on the side of the road. And so it was interesting in that way, and that, you know, you feel really bad when it happens. You're like, oh my God, she just got shot. But then you think about it and you're like, well, you know, she was also a murderer.
She deserved it.
Just like she was a murderer just like all the other people. It's not like she deserved it, but it was like, it's a more complicated emotion than, oh, the bad guys got it, or the, you know,
like looking back on that,
the good guys got it.
Looking back on that scene is actually, I thought that maybe in some way her shooting the cop or the sheriff's deputy or some whoever that was mainly related.
They're in a convenience store, and a cop like pseudo makes them and starts following them. And when he pulls them over because of Billy Bob Thornton's bad behavior, she shoots him so that they can escape.
Yeah. Well, the fact that he was a cop, I think, kind of in retrospect, is mostly related to Bill Paxton, right? Maybe in a way. The fact that he was basically, I mean, I don't know if he raped her or whatever it was. I guess it was consensual, but anyway, she was underage and had that kid with her. And she never really got any kind of retribution. And the way her shooting that cop, him, acts kind of like a stand-in for Paxton, maybe? I don't know. Because that's the only character in the movie that she shoots, and that kind of also makes her like, okay, she's like a murderer, she's like beyond, you know, saving or whatever, like she's like crossed that line, and she does it with a cop. I mean, none of them.
I never got the impression that she was beyond, like, that murder alone. It was more kind of an act of survival, because it's like, you know, this is it, like our back is up against the wall. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, if I don't do this, we're done for. Like, all of us are done for. So I felt like it was, again, like she was sort of pushed to that area. Like, I felt like a lot of times when, like, bad things happen in this movie, it was because somebody else pushed it to that point. Like, when they go toward the end of the movie, when Billy Bob Thornton and the other guy who's with him go to the drug dealers, and, you know, they're like trying to make a deal with them, and then the drug dealers just want to like go back on the deal and rip them off. they're sort of pushed again into more violence. It's just like, well, you know, it's you or us basically at this point.
Yeah.
And you've forced our hand in this issue. So, you know, we're going to commit some more violence because you forced us into it. And so a lot of it is a, like, with the exception of the crime that opens the movie where they sort of, you know, they rob the drug dealer and then they do this sort of like execution style killing. Everything is sort of like being forced on them. It's like, okay, well, you have to do this or you're done for. You know, it's a survival mechanism to the, at that point. And even in that first sort of cold-blooded
That's not
killing.
Exactly true.
Wait, what now?
That's not exactly true.
What?
Because they kill all those more drug people because they won't give them as much money as they were supposed to get when they're in Houston or whatever.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They kill a bunch more people.
That's what I was talking about, like where the situation was okay until those people were like, no, you know, we're going back on the deal that we just gave you and, you know, you're going to have to live with it because, you know, you're
okay,
on the run.
I'm just saying that's not survival. That's them saying that they're not going to accept a new deal. That's not survival. Like, you can argue that with the cop, but I don't think you can argue that.
Well,
I don't agree with you. That's. I feel like they're a lot more sociopathic than you're giving them credit for.
Yeah. I mean, they do kill a whole bunch of innocent people for money at the very beginning of the movie, and in a really horrible and cold-hearted way.
It's true, yeah. But even in that scene, like, the woman spares, you know, the little child that they
yeah,
find.
Yeah, that's
there.
Just her, though.
And she's, yeah. But that's
they would have killed the baby.
Yeah, that's
they
true.
Yeah, they did
tell her to kill the child.
On ranks of sociopathy, I can't remember his name, but I think that the black criminal is a complete sociopath.
Pluto. Yeah.
Billy
Bob Thornton is just like a general, like, selfish dude.
Yeah. He's kind of an uneducated hothead, basically, like, throughout the movie.
Doesn't someone in the movie at some point say that Pluto has an IQ of 150 or something? Like,
I really hate
that. Throws
that
in there. It's like, why?
They mentioned that a couple times. They're like,
he's super smart.
It's just, ooh.
Like, they don't ever show him doing anything particularly smart.
No.
It just feels like one of those, like, I have a black friend, you know, type things where it's like, oh, we don't want it. It's like he's the worst guy in the movie, so we're going to give him this other thing to, like, you know, make it, like, not a stereotype or something, and I'm not even sure what was going on there.
He's a sociopath, like, with glasses.
Yeah. I wondered if the character Brother Mazzone was partially inspired by him in The Wire.
I don't know.
I did not like him as a character. I thought he was the most out of place character that I saw in The Wire.
Which character? Like, Brother Mazzone?
Brother
Mazzone.
Yeah, Brother Mazzone.
Okay.
I did not like him because he did not feel like he belonged in that scenario.
Yeah, he definitely seems like he escaped from a pulpier, like,
yeah,
like, for sure.
The way I described him when I first saw him to Ruben, I was like, he felt like he belonged in, like, a Frank Miller comic.
So I want to talk about that opening scene and kind of, like, actually, it's really weird that we started off talking about the end and moving backwards.
Sorry, sorry.
But
it'll be like my least favorite trope.
One week earlier.
except we put that, like, at the end of the movie. Like, we talk about the end for, like, an hour, and then we talk about the beginning for, like, 2 minutes. Yeah. It'll just be a total inversion.
When I was talking about the film being kind of frustrating for me, I think, like, the beginning is part of what I'm talking about. And I don't know how you guys felt about it, but I sort of, like, I was really taken by the opening scenes of the film and, like, how brutal they were. In particular, there's a shot where I didn't know that he was going to, like, kill those people. He was, like, you know, like, wrapping them up and, like, taping their hands or something like that. And then you see the video of they've been recording themselves like having a party, and so there's a video of them playing in the background, and she's like dancing, like one of the women, and he's stabbing the person who's dancing in real life, while there's the video of her dancing behind, and he's kind of like moving, like I'm sure he's like trying to like supposed to be like holding her still, but he's kind of moving like with the music, and this like extremely creepy visual link between her fun and his fun.
And also her being alive and her dying.
Yeah, and like a visual like, representation. It's of like her the still destruction of
that like vibrance of life
in one scene, and like the creepiness of her living on.
Yeah.
In video form,
and I
and like that whole scene, I was like, oh my god, because like I said, there were parts about Devil in a Blue Dress that I liked, and so like that opening scene, I was like, oh my god, this movie is going to be crazy. And then like sort of after that, it was like there was the scene in the convenience store that was pretty tense, and then again like the shootout scene at the end was pretty good, but like a lot of the stuff in the middle, I was kind of like, wow, they started off with like the craziest, most intense scene in the entire film, and then there's like 60 minutes of just driving, like just people driving back and forth places, or like asking like this random person like a question, and they're like, hey, have you seen so-and-so? Who? No, I haven't seen him. And it was like, what was with all that filler? It's like, how do you make a scene that's like that intense, and then the rest of your movie, like, you know, there's like 60 minutes of like stuff that's not intense?
Yeah, I've read some praise of the movie for that, for exactly that, actually, where they praise the director for like really being like loosening up the tension as the further you get towards the ending. Like instead of just amping everything up, for some reason they just everything just takes incredibly long to like come together. Like even when it's supposed to be like, oh, they'll be here any minute, it's like, no, they're not. It's really going to take a long time until they get anywhere close to where, like, the Billy Bob Thornton and Pluto, until they get close to Fantasia. It takes forever. They have to drive Fantasia, over there.
That was her name.
That was...
It's kind of like...
Like, I don't know, it was weird. It was, like, a really weird effect. I'm not really sure that I thought that it was bad, because in a weird way, it was like... It was, like, unexpected, you know? Instead of, like, having the usual... Like, oh, we're going to build this shit up until it, like, explodes. It was more like you have, like, constantly, like, ebbs and flows all the time, you know?
It was so strange that, like, in a way, the cops, like, solved the case in, like, the second scene. It's like the crime is introduced, and then you think the movie's going to be, like, the cat and mouse thing. Like, the cops getting closer and closer until they finally, you know, catch them in the end. But, like, the second scene, like... There's just, like, some pretty decent police work, and then they're like, we know who it is who committed the crime, and we know where they're going, and then it's just, they're just sitting there waiting for them for the rest of the movie.
Yeah, well, yeah. It becomes more about, I guess, like, discovering the, you know, the characters of the people who committed the crime. Because you get to find out more about, you know, mostly about Fantasia and Bill Paxton, basically. And it becomes more about, like, does he feel like he wants to reconcile with her in any way for what he did to her? Because he starts...
But most of that's withheld until the end of the movie. A lot of it's just, like...
Well, some of it, though, is about, like, building up his... relationship to the cops. Like, it starts off like he's all gung-ho for helping them, you know, in any way, but then it also, like, you see that relationship develop between him and the LA cops, where he starts to feel more like an outsider in the situation, and I think that contributes to his desire to help her out of that situation as opposed to just going ahead and turning her in.
Yeah, I think there's also an element of him wanting to be the hero. Mm. And, like, if they swoop in, they'll, like, take his glory from the fact that he could kill those dudes and be the badass. But I was going to say, I think that the thing that makes what Ruben is talking about filler in a way that I agree with is that a lot of it's like kind of scripted in a weird way where like things don't add up that much. Like when they identify that Pluto is one of the people, one of the two killers, like they say something about him liking knives and that he's paroled recently. And I'm like, if this guy's like known for just murdering people with knives, how is he out of prison at all? Like,
just murdering people with knives.
Like the weird, like sort of like police, like off the cuff kind of talking thing makes it sound like, oh yeah, he's done this before, but like,
oh, he's murdered a bunch of people with knives before.
Oh, that Pluto. So, like, yeah. Things like that just made it feel, like, kind of loosey-goosey, and, like, Billy Bob and the guy that covered up the script with him didn't care that much about the police work aspect, and that gives it less importance because they're, like, I don't know, it's sort of central to like setting up the idea of who the characters are. I think that Pluto's obviously kind of the most underdeveloped, and that's weird since he's in the movie so much. Like,
yeah,
to, he exists mostly just as like a menacing presence that could do whatever, whenever he wants, including grab Billy Bob Thornton in the hotel in a really weird, stagey looking fight.
Yeah, I mean, looking at that scene, it's so, like, I think the first time I watched it, I was mainly just asking the question why Fantasia is with Billy Bob Thornton and not that other way more good-looking, more calm and collected black fella, you know? Why this raggedy-ass-looking Billy Bob Thornton guy? He's like,
because Billy Bob Thornton,
he's so disgusting. Yeah, exactly. So I think in the end, it's like, you know, Bill Paxton basically ruined her life and kind of made her into this, like, okay, fine, I guess I'll just date terrible white people now person, you know, like, I'll just hang on to them for as long as it goes, you know.
Unattractive and bills for the rest of life.
Unattractive bills, exactly. God.
It is true that your mind builds up an association to the first person that you have sex with. So.
Right, and he was the first, right? He was her first.
Yeah, I assume so.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it doesn't. She says that in the movie.
Yeah, she does.
I think, she does, okay. I couldn't remember if she said it explicitly in the movie.
She tells him like that. Yeah, that he knew that he was her first, something like that. Like,
yeah.
Which makes it even weirder.
I thought I remembered her saying that at some point, but I couldn't remember if I was, you know, just projecting that from what she was saying, or if it was explicitly stated.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know in how far in the weird way she's kind of like a tragic mulatto kind of character, or some crap like that, because.
Is that a type? I've never heard.
Yeah,
that
type. The tragic mulatto. Yeah. That is a type. I'm a little behind on my racial Hollywood stereotypes, but I think that is a type. And she
can't live in either world.
Exactly. Yeah. And she does mention at some point that her father was white, right? And that that Bill Paxton thought that he could have her, right? Because he wanted to have her because she was also white in a way, but then he could dump her because she was black. And that's like a typical kind of thing that goes on with tragic mulatto characters. Like they're being used from both sides, and like they can't find their own allegiance, and in the end they, you know, tragically.
Right. Yeah, I had never heard that stereotype, and it makes sense.
Yeah,
the way you explain it.
There's a number of movies like that sort of concern themselves with that. Among them, I don't know. Like, I just have to Google some. But
well, I was gonna say, wasn't there an episode of Angel that had a character like that?
I don't know
if we should.
I think it was the one where they like. Get the hotel or whatever, like
I don't know if she's
I think she's just passing.
I feel really uncomfortable saying the word mulatto. I think she is an albino black.
Well, I thought she was only like a very small percentage black.
I don't remember.
She was mostly white.
It's actually, funnily enough, almost the exact same plot as Devil in a Blue Dress, that episode of Angel, which is also directed by Carl Franklin.
I think it's a pretty direct reference on purpose, right?
Yes, I agree. Yes.
Makes sense.
So. bring it back.
There we go. Yeah, there we go.
Carl Franklin. This is what he concerns himself with.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah, Imitation of Life was the one that was looking for, was the most famous example of something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But even though that movie's more about passing for white than the tragic mulatto thing, but that enters into it too. But here, I think in a weird way, because I was thinking about how in the end she is like the most tragic character in the whole film, because she is basically used by everyone and has almost no agency of her own, that she can like influence things as she wants them to be, and she just tries all kinds of things that none of them work out. And I also agree that that scene in the what was it, in that convenience store, was one of the high points also. I agree with that. Like the way the tension was built up there. That was really, really good. And the way she played in that scene was really, really great, I thought. That she was like constantly hovering between pleasing everyone in that room. Like she was trying to calm down Billy Bob Thornton and trying to calm down the cop and calm down the girl at the register,
yeah,
that nobody loses their shit and so on. I thought that was like really, really nicely
one of the
played.
Undertones that I liked about that scene was that, like, on the one hand we want the cop to catch them because they're murderers, on the other hand we know that part of the reason why he's paying attention to them is because they're a mixed couple, and that like we're like, leave them alone. I'm feeling both at the same time. I'm kind of like, you need to catch them because they're drug selling murderers. At the same time, you don't need to be looking at them just because it's a black woman with a white man.
Right.
I like that tension in that scene.
And the way it ends, right, with the girl at the register telling the cop, you know what, she's too young for you, and he's like, I like him young.
You're like, oh, kinda, brother.
Just kind of, just ever so slightly makes you feel not so bad that cop gets shot a little while later on. Yeah,
I hardly ever feel bad when cops get shot, I'll just be honest.
That even foreshadows the reveal at the end of Bill Paxton being the father of her child.
Makes him even more of a stand-in, like Ilya argued.
Yeah,
it's true.
It's true.
Was anyone else surprised by it? Oh, like I actually kind of assumed that that's what it was, like almost right away, because there's like a weird scene where he goes to visit and then the black LA cop was like, hey, how do you know her anyway? And like Bill Paxton freaks out for no reason.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, oh, so that's his kid, right? And then I was right.
I don't remember that scene.
whenever they first like mentioned her name and he was like, he like froze up or whatever, I knew that what was going to happen. But there was an earlier scene also that hinted at it that I completely read the wrong way.
Yeah.
There's a scene where he's like drives up to like a like little restaurant, or I guess in today it would be a food truck, but it's not actually a truck back in that day, but it's like a little, I don't know, like diner where you walk up to a window and they give you some food, and someone is there with his kid, and there's like this really dramatic music playing, and like this couple is like talking to him and he's like not paying any attention to them, and he's just like staring at the kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
it's foreshadowing that he's like keeping an eye on the kid and that like he's invested in him. But I completely read it as like, this dude is super racist.
Yeah, that's the way I read that scene too. Because it was like
I was like, there's just like a black person near him and he can't stop looking at him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right.
Well, wasn't it like, a white person with the kid or something like that?
There was
like
a white and a black person together. With the kid at that point.
Yeah, it's one of her brothers, yeah. I think.
But then I thought that there was, I thought there was some white person with him, or maybe he thought
there's a couple in a truck, a white couple in a truck, and they're talking about they just got back from their honeymoon or something, and he is ignoring them to stare at his kid.
At the kid and the brother.
Yeah, I remember that. I forgot about that scene, but I do remember that now.
I think what I thought it was he thought that the baby looked more white than black or something like that, because the baby does, you know, the baby is a mixed baby.
I thought that's why
he was looking. He was like, oh, I can't believe, you know, black and white people are having sex. Like, that's what I thought was going on when I first saw that scene. Yeah, I remember that now. So I thought it was just like a stereotypical,
there's a young black guy, he might be doing something wrong, I better keep my eye on him.
Yeah. Definitely played with that intention.
That too, yeah. But then you see him looking at him later in the movie, and I was like, oh, he's looking at him because he thinks he's doing something wrong. Like, he saw that guy earlier in the movie. But then you find out the reason he's really looking at him is because he knows him, and he knows, you know, the child, too. And I was like, okay, now... Right, now I remember.
I really like how we just read all that into Bill Paxton's face. Like, just the way he was looking. I like the fact that his actor's face allows for this much ambiguity in the interpretation. It's pretty great.
Good job, Bill Paxton.
This movie is called One False Move, which is like a very stereotypical thriller type title, and is like exactly the kind of like if you were to see a movie called like One False Move on TV, you would probably never watch it.
Yeah.
Of the title.
Yeah.
And it's doubly strange because this movie is filled with false moves. There is not like a singular moment where everyone is like, this Ilya reminded me of this when he was saying that like Fantasia is used by everyone around her. Like, literally every decision that everybody makes almost from the beginning of this movie is bad.
Pretty much, yeah. I don't know, is it referring to the fact that they leave the videotape in the machine at the beginning? I couldn't figure out what the false,
I think
the one
it's the
false
kid,
move.
That they don't kill the kid.
Oh, maybe. Well, maybe. But
I mean, that's how they identify her, which wasn't expressed that clearly, but that, like, the kid overheard them saying names and recognized people's faces or something, and that's how they solved the crime so quickly.
I thought because he's alive. The way that they knew where to look for them, though, was the videotape, because they have them saying Star City in the background on the videotape, and that's how they knew where to look for them. So that's
why
they
wouldn't even know who they were looking for if it wasn't for the kid.
It's true, yeah.
That scene, like, they took that, like, one or two scenes or whatever, that's like the cop scenes, and then they turned those two scenes into literally like years and years worth of television that exists now. Like, basically every cop procedural is just those two scenes, except for 45 minutes instead of for two scenes.
Wait a second, slow that down. Yeah. That's the quality.
Remove the distortion.
Yeah. Enhance.
So simple. You just press a few buttons and the distortion is gone.
As you guys probably all know, like, in my enjoyment of good cop work is when cop work is like really bad and nonsensical like this. It's really frustrating. Like, when they were watching the video, I was like, oh, this is interesting. I wonder what they're going to take out of it. And I'm like, oh, they're just going to invent science that doesn't exist.
Science!
When you guys were, like, saying, like, you didn't know, like, what maybe you were going to say about this movie, I felt kind of similar after I finished watching it. And so I decided to, like, look up stuff about the movie, which I hadn't been doing so much for other movies that we podcasted. And I discovered that Siskel and Ebert, this was their number one movie of 1992. It was Siskel's number one and Ebert's number two, so it was number one on their combined list. And I thought that that was very strange.
Yeah.
And like, and so
they really,
like, I watched the...
They do this every now and again. Like, they just pick the most random movie to be like the best movie ever, and then they just pick 10 completely obvious movies to be their favorite movies. But every now and again, they do something weird like that to remind you that they're like not completely robots. So yeah,
that's just the only reason for One False Move's success and fame is that. Siskel and Ebert attempting to prove that they're not robots. What is that noise? Who is making that noise?
It's not me.
It's not
the click 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 noise.
That just now.
Yeah.
Again. Oh yeah, that's you, Patrick. You're hitting your thing, I think.
Oh, sorry. It's probably okay. I see what it's doing. It's the computer. I was like, it's not even plugged into my recording device, and then I realized I was recording on this and not that. But I don't.
Okay.
What is it?
Anyway.
I don't know what that is.
Anyway.
So first of all, I watched their whole like best of 1992 episode because I found it online, and they didn't say anything about the movie. I don't know if that's like typical of their. Television reviews in general, but they were just like, this is a taut thriller and smartly made or something like that. I'm like, that's not helpful.
It's not. No, and then, they generally like review it. On the episode that they review it on, they'll say more about it.
I hate the adjective taut with the word thriller next to it. It's just
me too.
It's like,
I don't like anything to be taught.
Really. It's like the roll-licking adventure movie, right? It's just like whatever Peter Travers writes in his fucking reviews.
And so then I was like, and then my second thought about that was how weird it is that Siskel and Ebert said that this was the best movie of the year, and that Carl Franklin like hasn't really done anything. Like, can you think of any other instance in which, like, you know, the most important tastemakers in a field would say like, this is the best, and not like blow up huge.
Oh yeah, Dark City. Like, remember Dark City? I think Roger Ebert.
Yeah,
that was just
that
Ebert. Like,
that was just
that
Ebert, though.
Oh, not both
Siskel
of them.
Siskel liked that movie, but not as much.
Okay, because I remember Roger Ebert gave it 4 stars and really hyped it, and it just didn't go anywhere whatsoever. Like, I don't even remember who did that movie.
The guy who did The Crow. Alex Proyas.
Right.
He's still working in a capacity that Carl Franklin is not.
Yeah.
He did. Didn't Proyas direct the Nicolas Cage movie Knowing?
Yes, and he also did I, Robot with Will Smith.
Okay.
Carl Franklin has done some episodes of television.
And he also did that movie Bless Me Ultima that just came out.
Of the show television?
Bless Me Ultima wasn't made by a movie studio, though. It was made like entirely off of like a trust fund or donations or like a nonprofit organization or something like that. So it's like since out of time, he hasn't been working in Hollywood.
Yeah. I mean, Devil in a Blue Dress, I remember it cost kind of a lot of money, and then it wasn't nearly as big a commercial hit as they were hoping, so that could have also contributed. Because, I mean, Denzel Washington was a pretty huge star at that point. That was after Philadelphia.
Yeah.
I mean, not that Philadelphia made him a big star, I guess.
It was a hit.
Glory made him a big star.
Right. But I just mean, like, Philadelphia
and
was extremely...
Crimson Tide.
So anyways, I thought it was kind of strange, and I don't know, I guess I hope that he gets to make some more films in the future, because I feel like he definitely has, you know, something going there that's really interesting.
Like, a lot of the black filmmakers that were given opportunities and made some like weird offbeat work in the early 90s are now, like, if they're still working, doing stuff like that. Like Ernest Dickerson, who did Surviving the Game and a couple other pretty weird movies. Now he just directs episodes of The Walking Dead.
Yeah, he did some episodes of The Wire, too, and then some other TV shows. So he's just like a
director. But The Walking Dead is awful, which is why...
It really is.
Surviving the Game is such a blunt, like, look at society.
Yeah. Yeah.
Surviving the Game cracks me up thinking about it.
It's like, how can we show that, like, rich people use poor people? It's like, what if they hunted homeless people?
They can hunt iced tea.
Yeah. I remember
that's a really developed metaphorical situation you've got
there. The first time I watched that movie was on Russian TV in Russian. And it was like the way it was advertised was like, get ready for like a really fun movie. this guy.
It is a fun movie.
This black homeless guy is going to be running away from Rutger Hauer and what? And Gary Busey. God, Jesus. That really blew my mind. I was like 14 or something. It really, really screwed with me. Like that sort of like what I was expecting. I was expecting a fun ride, and then it was really just anything but that. It was just really depressing and kind of terrible in so many ways.
F. Murray Abraham's gonna scream.
Yeah. But Rutger Hauer is really big in Russia, so they really love him in pretty much anything. So whenever he stars in anything, it's like, hey, here comes another Rutger Hauer movie coming at you.
I feel like he chases people down to murder them in most of the movies.
Yes, he does enjoy that. He does gravitate towards those roles. It's true.
And he's always chasing them, too.
I remember seeing an interview with him where he was talking sort of funnily, like kind of pretentiously about his process and like really getting into the guts of the character. And it made me laugh really hard because then I remembered like Nighthawks or whatever that.
Yeah, with Sylvester Stallone.
Yeah.
Where he dresses up like a woman. Sylvester Stallone in drag was their greatest weapon in that movie.
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, man. So I think we've said everything that we had to say about One False Move.
I pretty much covered what I wanted to say, although I just go back to when I mentioned the opening scene. And then sort of my complaint about how I felt like the rest of the film didn't deliver on that opening scene. But then no one else got to say whether or not they liked the opening scene, which I kind of hoped to cover, and whether or not anyone else had any thoughts on the opening scene.
Yeah, I thought it was really, really intense. I was pretty amazed how, like, considering I had watched The Act of Killing before that, I felt more emotionally visceral during this opening scene than I did at any point in that movie, which is about real murderers.
I felt like it went out of its way to disprove the racial stereotype of all black people being good at dancing.
I thought they were going to be really like shitty dancing they were doing there. So I was really surprised that they all got killed off so quickly.
I felt like actually, it really caught me off guard. Like the opening scene almost made me not want to watch the movie right away because actually I was like, oh, okay, I'm not ready for this. Like I'm not ready for like a movie filled with this, like Billy Bob Thornton hunting people for sport, basically,
and punching women in the face.
Right. It was like boom, like right from this from the start. It really like starts off with this terrible, right, ongoing act of violence keeps going and keeps getting more horrible and more horrible, and then it really doesn't never picks that up again, you know, like just kind of lays there lately.
I agree though, like how surprising it was, because it really pulls the rug out from under you in a way, and that you get this scene that's like you know, these people like having like a really good time and like socializing, and like you're really sort of sold on the party, like at the first part, and you're like, this is fun. It's like, I'm gonna get to like, you know, like party a bit, and you're like, and then this other stuff will come later, I guess. And it's just like, you know, and they're like even talking to her about it. It's like, hey, you're always welcome here as long as you don't bring your bad guy around. And you're like, oh, okay, so that's what's going to happen, is this bad guy is going to come in eventually
and ruin everything.
And it's like, nope, he's right there. And now he's
at the door. He it's heard like, what you said, and he's coming to get you.
They were really right to say that he was not allowed to
come. Indeed.
Actually, maybe this would be an interesting moment to mention that I didn't know that Carl Franklin was black, the director, until actually later, after I'd already finished the movie. Pretty sure that that influenced some readings that I had of it from the start. But I was actually mostly kind of like anxiously looking forward to how Billy Bob Thornton would write a black people dance party, right? What was going on in the beginning. It's like, how would Billy Bob Thornton write this scene of black people basically hanging out together and dancing and like, you know, like, what would I be expecting here? And then it definitely wasn't that. Like, it definitely wasn't that scene, but maybe that was actually for the better, because I don't know if the other thing would have been worse in some way. If it was like just Billy Bob Thornton like writing African-American like slang or whatever, or like how black people, this is how I think black people talk at parties, you know, that would have been maybe even more scary than the opening actually was.
Maybe that's what the scene originally was, and then Carl Franklin was like, no.
No. No.
We're just gonna have them eat chips and dance.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Does anyone else have anything they want to say?
No, I don't.
One false move.
I think we're, I think we've made enough false moves.
All the right moves.
For one podcast.
So okay. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you next time. Bye.
See you next time. Bye-bye. Bye.
Okay, Patrick, start the podcast after this.
I will do that.
Don't talk after I say it.
Did you just make a photo of us, Basil? That's pretty cool.
It's a video.
Everyone stop talking.
All right. I guess it's gotten out of hand already. We made one false move. This podcast has gotten out of hand.
All right, that's the last pun.